Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Shows, live on air myeloma support group meeting. I am Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, joining all of you from India, and I welcome everyone this evening to our September meeting. We have with us our support group meeting leaders, Pat Killingsworth and Cynthia Shmulevsky. Matt Goldman is unable to join us today. Welcome, Pat and Cindy. It's great to have you here for another meeting of our support group. Pat Killingsworth is a myeloma survivor and author of 4 myeloma-related books and maintains 2 blogs where he documents his myeloma journey. Cynthia is a myeloma survivor and an active member of the Philadelphia Multiple Myeloma Networking Group, a trained mentor and participates in several online communities. She's also very active on Twitter. I would like to take this opportunity to mention that people from as far away as Australia are listening to our meetings, and I think that's truly remarkable. Till date, we have had over 5,000 people participating in our meetings by listening in or sending us their questions. Thank you, everyone. Pat, one of our participants, Anne, she writes in to say that her husband, David, will be in the hospital for 5 days of chemo. In preparation for a stem cell transplant, which is to take place on October 21st. And so she'll be listening to the show. And we wish David the very best. Pat, you would like to add something for Anne?
I guess all I can say is been there, done that. And best of luck.
Yeah, that's right. Today we are excited to welcome amidst us Paula Van Riper, who is a myeloma survivor, and Paula will be sharing her story with us today. Welcome to the Cure Panel's live support group meeting, Paula. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, Paula. I've been forward to this opportunity, and I want to thank you for the invitation.
Okay. It's great having you here, Paula. We have received a lot of questions from members, and eventually we will be getting to them. Before we begin the meeting, I would like to share this, that all callers who want to speak with the support group leaders can either press 1 on their keyboards and we'll be bringing them live to ask their questions, or they can even send the questions via email to priya@trialex.com and we will try to address them in the meeting. I will now hand over to Pat Killingsworth, who would introduce us to the guest and begin with the meeting. Pat, you're on.
Thank you, Priya, and welcome, Paula, and Cindy, glad you're with us, too.
Thank you.
I think, Paula, as you can tell, this can be a little difficult. There's a bit of a delay.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you just share your story with us, and I think the reason that we invited you on as a guest will become clear as you go. So, please take some time and fill us in.
Okay, sure. I was diagnosed with myeloma 14 years ago in August of 1999. I was very startled, like most of us, to even hear of a disease called multiple myeloma. My disease was a little unusual in that it manifested as a single solitary plasmacytoma in my right femur, and I was very close to actually fracturing my leg, so it was an emergency. And the emergency was to give me a hip replacement, which they did. And a week or so later, when the surgery was over and I was up and about, they went, "Well, see ya. Go figure out what you want to do with your myeloma. We're done with you." And so I went home stunned. It took a little while. I did a little research. Actually, one of the first sites I was on was the International Myeloma Foundation, and I called their hotline. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't even read about it. I needed to talk to a human being. So the IMF has been, near and dear to my heart because they immediately helped me kind of calm down and approach the disease in a very more of a fact-finding kind of way to figure out what I could do. Well, I was blessed with about 3 years of stable disease. By virtue of the hip replacement, they kind of sort of put me in remission, so my numbers weren't that bad. And the treatment at that point was worse than the disease. So the message I got from many doctors was, wait and see. You don't have enough disease to treat you, which ordinarily you might think, oh, well, that's good news, but it isn't. It's a very difficult position to be in when you know you have a disease and everything has been told, you know, your whole life, it's all prevention and what can you do and let's catch it early. But nonetheless, I after the third doctor telling me wait and see, I finally accepted it. I accepted it, but not emotionally. I still wanted to do something. I was anxious to do something. But, you know, I had to wait, and 3 years I went to check the blood work and did all that. And then when it came time to, well, the numbers are high enough, although I was still feeling quite well, and there was no clear parameters at that point, like should you treat well with what? Well, again, now we're talking 2001, early part of 2002. There weren't a lot of options. So I opted to go directly to transplant, which I did. In 2002, I had two transplants. Why two? Well, the first one was Norado, and the second one was recommended because at the time I had the cytogenetics test, and it determined that I had deletion 13. And back then, deletion 13 was more serious, as best as they can tell, and that it was a serious poor prognosticator, indicating that a single transplant wouldn't be enough. And they recommended that, not a tandem, but they recommended that if I had a sibling, that I would consider a mini allogeneic transplant. And again, you know, it's still early in your disease. You have only a couple of years. You're relying on your doctors. And I checked, and one of my younger brother actually was my match. So good or bad or whatever, I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I did have the mini allo in November of 2002. I guess it was the right decision because I'm now talking to you many years later. And I did not, fortunate that I had very, very mild GVHD, and which was easily eradicated, and it has never returned. So I benefited by those transplants that gave me about almost 5 years of drug-free. So I gained a whole 5 years, and during those 5 years, there were drugs being in the pipeline, FDA approval, so things, it was a blessing for me, because it gave me those 5 years of no treatment. And then I progressed, and then that was 2007. I had a compression fracture in my spine, and we radiated that. And that's when I started RevDex. For the first time, I was actually taking something, you know, a real chemotherapy regimen. And actually, I tolerate RevDex pretty well. I've been very, very lucky over these years. Everything they've given me, I've responded in a positive way, at least for some period of time. And so that I feel like at this point, 14 years later, yeah, I've done pretty well. You know, I've tolerated whatever regimen that I was provided, and, you know, maybe some tweaking here and there, but nonetheless, I was able to benefit by each one of the therapies. So I was on RevDex for a while, but then I had neutropenia, white blood count. I had low white blood counts from Revlimid. So after about maybe 2 years or so, it was a struggle, and we decided that maybe I should have a drug holiday that's what happened. So I took a little bit of a drug holiday, but it didn't last very long. And in 2009, July is not a good month for me, as you'll see. It's really not a good month. So I'm thinking I should just go on a worldwide cruise every July. But anyway, in July of 2009, I progressed again. And at that point, we decided to try VDR, okay, Dex and Revlimid. And I only did a couple cycles, and I started to get that, that tingling. So the doctor said, no, that's the beginning of neuropathy. Let's not go there. And so we went off of that. But my numbers weren't horrible, so they decided to just kind of, again, put me back into that watch and wait category. And it wasn't until, and when I stay there, that's 2009, now we're talking 2010, things are, the numbers are starting to rise, I don't have any serious pain, and then it didn't take very long when my back started to bother me again. And that's when we took a closer look, and Spike had gone up, and the PET scan said, yeah, there's a little activity there, we need to do something. So in July of 2010, I started POM, the trial for POM Dex. Why? Well, at that point, I had used up Velcade. I had done the Revlimid Dex, but it was, and here's POM, the next generation of Revlimid. So the doctors and I said, well, wait a minute, if I responded positively to Revlimid and tolerated it pretty well, except for the neutropenia, the likelihood is that I might get a good response from POM. And so we started, and that was on a trial. And I was on that trial, well, I'm still on the drug, quite frankly. So I've been on POM Dex almost continuously since July of 2010. And so it's 3 years later. Now, the first 3 years, POM was on the trial, and so it was very controlled. And then I started on 4 milligrams, 4 milligrams of POM, 40 milligrams of Dex. And it took 1 year for that combination to, maybe even a little less than that, I think 9 months, to bring my M-spike to zero. And I think my M-spike going into it might have been something like 1.4, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. So I responded very well, and we were very pleased that I'm now at zero. And but it did come with a little bit of a price. Pomalidomide, as it calls now, was fatigue. Fatigue certainly was the number one side effect that I felt from the introduction of that drug. Dex is another story. The side effects of Dex are clearly separate, but I'm trying to isolate the side effects of the POM. And I also knew that because it was a trial, that in my center, it was 4 milligrams. Other centers around the country, they were trying to figure out the right dosage, was 3 milligrams. And I was kind of jealous because I'm taking 4, but other centers are taking 3, and I've always been less is better. I want to take the least amount to get the best result. But if I could, so after about a year, I started talking to my doctors. Oh, now that I've gotten such a good response and I'm really fatigued from it, what do you think about a dose reduction? Well, on a trial, once you go down, you cannot go back up. So there was a risk involved that if I went down to 3, perhaps, and it didn't hold me, I couldn't go back up, and that drug is not commercially available. Wow. So I had to think about that. Well, and so we talked about, by the way, the Dex was an issue, so we kind of modified that earlier. So I went from 40 to 20, which helped. But now then we're back to, should we dose reduce the pomalidomide or not? And I don't know why, but again, I felt like I could do this. So about a year and a half into the POM Dex trial, I dose reduced to 3 milligrams. And nothing happened. The numbers stayed at zero. I was joyful. Even though I'm tired, I was joyfully tired. About another year later, I pushed it just a little too far. Again, these are not, those reductions were not being promoted by my doctor. This is something I was promoting. And at that point, I said, well, it was a few months, it was late, I guess it was late 2012 or so, maybe the fall, and I wanted to go to 2, which they agreed. They told me the parameters, but I also was thinking, well, guess what? If I don't do well, it's going to get FDA approval soon, and then it might be commercially available. Well, so that played into my thought process, which I did go to 2. And probably within 2 or 3 months, the zero was gone, and it became 1.1, 0.3, 0.4. And so it was obvious that 4 was okay for me, 3 was okay for me, but 2 milligrams clearly wasn't. And it was this past spring, and then I had back pain occur in June, and it was clear that I needed to do something else. So we went back to POM at 4 milligrams and DEX at 40 milligrams, and we added carfilzomib. So that's where I am today. I'm taking now those 3, carfilzomib, DEX, and pomalidomide, but back at the 4 milligram. And it's my 3rd cycle. And so far, my end spike has gone down, not dramatically, but, and I don't need dramatic results. I just wanting slow and steady won the race, right? So I think it was 1.4, and then it went to 1.1, and last month it was 1.0, and today I went for blood work. So the jury's out. We don't know what's happening this cycle, but, you know, it's quite a bit more than Palm Dex. Palm Dex was so easy because it was a pill. It was lovely. You stopped in once a month. Life goes on. They give you your pills, and you don't see the doctor again for a month. It's a beautiful thing. Carfilzomib, it's an infusion, back-to-back, 3 weeks of the month. You're off a week. It's a different story. Now you are facing the disease on a very regular basis. But at the other hand, I'm really glad carfilzomib is available to me and was ready when I was ready. So, yes, I probably had a good time on Pomdex for 3 years, but now I'm carfilzomib. I just want carfilzomib to work. And that's my story. If somebody has any particular questions about POM that they would like me to respond to, I'd be happy to do so.
Thanks, Paula. That was great. And so I think listeners can figure out one of the reasons why we wanted to invite you on this evening, and that's the fact that you've used not one, but both of the newly approved FDA drugs last year, pomalidomide and carfilzomib, or Pomalyst and Kyprolis. And I guess I didn't realize you were still using POM. I thought you had switched over just to Kyprolis, so you're using both of them.
Well, there was that. That was one of the options, Pat. The options, you know, that when I discussed it with my doctor, we could do Kyprolis and Dex alone, or just go back, add it to the Pomalyst, go back to the original dosage of POM, and add it to. So we debated that a little bit. And I think the decision really was, since I responded so positively to pomalidomide or Pomalyst, that we would have perhaps a better response if we went, and it's not been that long that I've been on it, that we'll leave the POM in place and then just add carfilzomib. Now, remember, now I'm 14 years, so my doctor likes to refer to me as heavily treated, and he worries about getting a response from me because the disease gets pretty tricky and the disease gets pretty adept at morphing and changing, and since I've had so many treatments, it's harder for to get a response from me than perhaps someone who's had early disease that doesn't have a whole history, and so it's perhaps just carfilzomib dex might be, and I just talked to a woman the other night who just did carfilzomib dex, and she got an excellent response. And so in my case, we just felt that, and since I did tolerate POM, even though it was tiring, I work every day, so I'm still working and I'm able to work. So, you know, you have to, when people say, you know, how tired are you? I'm not that so tired that I stay in bed. I'm tired, I go to work, but I'm more tired, you know, than maybe on my typical day. So did I tolerate it? I tolerated it. I was more than willing to go back to the POM at 4 milligrams and add carfilzomib.
Sure,
so,
you were fatigued, but you point out the third, other than the fact that everyone, I know Paula very well, and she's just an awesome human being. She's wonderful and a good friend and bright as bright can be. But I think other than those things, the fact that you've used the 2 new drugs and that you're working. And you're working full-time, correct?
Yes, correct. I had to get somebody to relieve me. I said, quick, I have to be home by 6 o'clock.
There you go. So those three things, I think, make you unique and a wonderful guest for us tonight. And thanks again for coming on. Cindy, sitting
I'm
back
here.
There someplace listening, you're there, right?
I'm here. Yes, I am, Pat. Hi, Paula.
Hello, Cindy, my little friend from New Jersey also.
Yes, we're the Jersey girls over here.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I was up there visiting when I spoke to the sports group in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. Cindy, we didn't talk about this. How about you go ahead and ask Paula any questions you have, and just run down some of these. Do you have the list of questions that Priya forwarded us?
I do have the list of questions. So I just need to make the fonts a little bit bigger because my eyes aren't so good. Paula, no, well, I do have a question because my short-term memory is not as good as when you were telling your story. When you stopped responding to the pomalidomide at the 2 milligrams, did you go back to the 4 milligrams by itself to see if you would respond, or did you add the Kyprolis right away?
I'm not sure I heard your whole question, but I stopped responding to, well, when the 2 milligrams didn't hold me, I was kind
right.
of stuck there for a moment because chlorpheniramine, POM wasn't yet available. It was still in, I think POM got approved in February of this year, I believe.
Yes.
I think it was February, March. And last fall, it was obvious after only a couple months of taking the 2 milligrams that, I went from a 0 and spike to a 0.1 to a 0.2. But we didn't really have a choice then. I'm kind of stuck there because I couldn't go back up because I was on the trial.
It wasn't approved yet.
And the trial said, so we kind of just waited it out a little. I was feeling well. It was a chemical response. So we watched the numbers. But, again, that is a low M spike. For most people, that wouldn't have any particular meaning. But it did send a signal that 2 milligrams perhaps was not sufficient for me. So I was being watched clinically each month. But really,
okay.
there wasn't really much to do. The plan was, well, let's see what happens. And knowing the FDA approval was coming, and that was my ace in the hole, so to speak. As soon as it became FDA approved, I could drop out of the trial and become eligible for it commercially.
Okay.
So that was the plan. And pretty much it kind of followed that plan. It did work out that way. It was just a little bit later, the FDA approval and the paperwork and all. So it wasn't until maybe April or maybe May when I went back to the POM at 4 milligrams. But then at that point I did have, and I'm somewhat unique in that my M spike doesn't have to be really high for me to have a tumor. We discovered that in 2007, and everyone has individual disease, and I strongly urge people to become very knowledgeable about their own particular disease and to really take that information and analyze it and look back at where were you when you progressed and what did your relapse look like, where did it occur. And my relapse, my initial diagnosis was a tumor in the femur. In 2007, after my transplants, my next, progression of disease was a compression fracture in my spine. So it was very obvious that I have bony disease. I don't know what my M spike was at diagnosis because I probably didn't even know to ask about it. But in 2007, my compression fracture, my M spike was 1.3. Which isn't really very much for many people, many patients, but it was obvious that in my case, we can't let my end spike get too far out of control because I could easily have bone damage with a lower end spike. Well, there's other people walking around with a 2.1 end spike, and they feel well, and they do a PET scan, and they don't have any lesions.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's not me, though. So I get regular PET scans every 6 months to keep an eye on my disease. So we were a little nervous because, you know, my end spike was, you know, beginning to progress, but I was feeling okay, you know, until June when, oh, my back hurts again, and went to the PET scan, and sure enough, there's activity in there. And it was clear that I needed to make a decision, and that's when we decided to do the three regimen, you know, the three different, and put them together, and to have a better combination to hit it. Now, perhaps, if I didn't have any bone pain, and I just had a chemical progression where my numbers were there, but I was feeling well, and my PET scan came back fine, that there would be nothing. Maybe I would have considered maybe just carfilzomib dex alone. But that wasn't the case. And as soon as I had back pain and I had progression, you know, it felt that I needed to do more rather than less. And maybe going back to Pomdex might take longer, and it would have been okay, perhaps, maybe, to do just Pomdex, maybe. But as soon as I had bone pain, and I knew that that's how I manifest, and I needed to do more. So that's why I ended up getting carfilzomib to Pomdex.
Okay, great. Could you explain a little bit about the PET scan and how, you know, for our listeners, and how that may help identify where your bone pain is coming from, and why you have yours every 6 months, you know, and some doctors don't order it?
Yeah, that's interesting.
A little bit about PET scan?
Yeah, the PET scan, in my particular case, because, again, it's so hard. Some doctors, you know, promote it, and the insurance companies pay without it a problem. And in my case, my insurance company did not want to pay for a PET scan until my situation warranted it, which means I didn't have a PET scan done for, let's see, 14 years, I'm going to say, probably the first, well, I think it was after 2007, I know when. Up until 2007, my doctors felt comfortable monitoring my disease using blood work. They can get their M-spike and get the IgG. Everything was fine. And in 2007, when I had a tumor and my M-spike was 1.3, even the doctors said, whoa, you already have a compression fracture. Wow. And that takes a little while to have the vertebra completely compressed. You've had this for a while, and clearly your M-spike wasn't, you know, still low. So at that point, my doctors appealed to my insurance company and said, this patient, I cannot honestly monitor her disease adequately with just blood work. And, you know, I think they kind of pushed back, but a little pushback from the doctor. They approved it. And they said, okay, in her case, we will approve a PET scan every 6 months. And then the doctor said, that's more than adequate. And so in 2007, I started my PET scans every 6 months, which has been quite a relief for me because knowing that my blood work, my IgG has been normal for many, many, many years, even when I've progressed. So we know that my blood work isn't really reflective anymore. Are we at a point where they would call me a non-secretor? Not really, because it does reflect a little bit, but maybe not truly accurately how much disease I really have. So I am responding, and I do have an M spike, and I have an IgG, but not enough to really be comfortable. So I get my blood work done regularly, but the PET scan every 6 months really gives me insight into my bone, my skeleton, which is very sensitive about my skeleton. And the PET scan actually shows cancer activity. It doesn't show damage. It just shows what's active. And by comparing it from every 6 months, the reports, you can kind of, the report will indicate to you anything new, the size of the mass, the size of the activity, and just one snapshot really is helpful, but it becomes more helpful when you have the reports to examine year after year and compare them. So it has a lot of language in it that's hard to read, the report, but it does give you a summary. And, you know, I encourage people to really talk to their doctor about, you know, if you get a report and you don't understand it, ask. Just ask what it is. And you'll also get to know where your tumor activity is. And you'll see the opportunity for maybe I have a little, I remember learning that I had a manubrium, which I didn't know I had, and a manubrium turns out to be that little bony area on the top of your breastbone, and that's where I had a lesion. Well, I said, really? And the doctor said, oh, don't even worry about that. That's not weight-bearing. Well, so you kind of get a sense of, okay, I have lesions, but some are more important than others, and so the PET scan really gives you that opportunity to kind of zero in and peek into your body to find out, you know, do you have some activity? Where would it be? And it also gives you some really reassurance that with your regimen that you're on, which might very well happen, and it certainly happened to me, that 6 months later, that little spot that was in the manubrium is not there anymore. Why? Because the regimen that I was on effectively, systemically took care of the lesion. So it's a double-edged sword. It tells you activity, which you get scared, but at the other hand, it also tells you whether or not your treatment is effective. So the PET scans for me have been a vital component of my doctors trying to monitor me and keep an eye on my disease. Without it, they wouldn't have any idea, you know, especially if I was feeling well. Well, you know, and people say, well, I don't know, what do you feel? Well, everybody feels something different. So we also find that I have a very high tolerance for pain, apparently. And so by the time I really feel pain, something could be much more serious than someone else. So putting all these things together is what my doctors use and help me feel more comfortable understanding, you know, what am I due, and I'm going to get my PET scan in 3 months and we'll see where we are and we'll compare it. So it's just another part of the puzzle that we know your myeloma puzzle that you put together. And so having those pieces to the puzzle, you then can see the picture. So think of all those tests as a piece of a puzzle, and then when you step back, then you can see it holistically, and not focus on one piece of it. So it can be scary when you're trying to follow your numbers, but you really do need to step back and look at the bigger picture, see what those numbers represent.
Thanks, Paula. Yeah, and I like to reiterate that I've heard at many of the conferences that as your disease progresses and you're into it longer and longer, that sometimes your M spike may be lower, but your disease may be more active. So that's probably a good point where you do get a PET scan, you know, to see if there is any activity going on, even though your numbers are remaining the same.
Right, and then from the PET scan, the doctor might order an MRI, which might be quite different. Now, I want to also reiterate here that be careful. When you have a PET scan, it's going to show activity, but all the activity doesn't necessarily mean it's cancer activity. I mean, I have a lot of arthritis, so my arthritis is in my neck. It has nothing to do with my myeloma. So I kind of grow in my neck area as well, but that's been there consistently. So you do need to have this test done, and it gives you a lot of information, but you need to have it done more than once to get a sense of what your skeleton really looks like and where the activity is and what to follow up on.
Right. Yeah. One of my doctors had told me that even the glowing, as you said, some of it could be arthritis, and he gave me a number. I don't recall the number off the top of my head, but there are numbers of the amount of growing that you can do. And if it's a low number, that's more of an arthritic growth, you know, type of activity in your bone, where it's the higher numbers are where you have to be a little bit more concerned about. Let me get back to one of the questions. Pam asks, she wants to know if you experience any increase in your blood sugar while you're on the Pomalyst.
No, I haven't. I saw that question, and I thought about it, and I said, well, wait, no, but I've never had an elevated blood sugar. So, but if she has an elevated blood sugar, that might be something for her to watch. I noticed no difference, actually. My palm kept me, whatever, my creatinine levels, my neutropenia, and that was the other thing that was kind of curious. I expected that palm would respond, that I would respond to palm similar to Revlimid. And Revlimid did become a problem for me over time with my white blood count. And so I was expecting palm to do that and was prepared for that. And it never happened. So for 3 years, I took more than 3 years, I've been taking Pomalyst. And it hasn't had any effect on, has not given me any neutropenia. It was a surprise to me. And it just didn't happen. So even when you kind of think, well, yeah, I know my disease and this is what I think is going to happen, it surprises you. But I haven't had any elevation in my blood sugars.
Okay. Pat, do you have any questions or do you want me to continue asking some of the questions?
No, go ahead. That's great.
Okay.
I don't want to break the flow. You two work well together.
The Jersey girls are going.
Yeah, well, we were roommates this year at the support group leaders conference. Paula and I were roommates. We actually chit-chatted a whole lot then.
yeah, we did. And I was
really there you go. That explains it.
So I guess another big question for people are asking about is about diet. Do you do anything special for your diet because of the Kyprolis or anything special because of the myeloma, anything with your diet?
Well, no, I've never, diet has not been something that has been in the forefront of my mind most of the time. I mean, certainly knowing I have this disease, knowing that your body, it's important for you to be as healthy as possible, I did switch over, and I probably buy much more organic foods now than ever before. Am I conscious about, well, I didn't smoke, and do I still drink? Well, I have to admit, I do like my cocktail maybe or a glass of wine, but maybe once a week, maybe, not even. Other than that, I try to eat fresh vegetables. I love vegetables. I try to minimize red meat. I eat more fish. From that perspective, did I change my diet? Yes, I did. I did slowly change the diet, but I didn't do anything extreme. Do I take a vitamin? Yes, I take vitamins. The doctor suggested, my permanent doctor suggested additional vitamin D, calcium, the traditional stuff, which I do. And I no soda. I've never been a soda person. So I do kind of watch, you know, that part of it and know that, you know, in terms of energy, you know, too many carbs kind of slow you down, and I already have a little bit of fatigue. I don't want, even though I have to admit, crusty Italian bread is probably my downfall. That's my comfort food. So when I'm upset or distressed, I want to crunch on bread. Somebody else might want chocolate cake on my crusty bread, but it's only temporary until I get over that emotional hump. But other than that, I pretty much try to just eat in a healthy way, and more, like I said, more vegetables perhaps and less meat, and you know, more water and less. I never did soda very much, but maybe some juice, but not even a lot of juice because I know juice has a lot of sugar in it. So from that perspective, that's how I kind of manage my own diet.
Good. Pat, do you have anything? I know you're really big into diet.
Well, I think Paula of course, is really smart about this. You know, sure, it tastes great to have that Snickers bar, but if you crash 30 minutes later, you know, because you had a blood sugar spike, you know, that doesn't help, especially when you're already fatigued. So I think that's great advice. And I try to follow it. I've got a bad sweet tooth, but I try.
You like your soda, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Right, Pat?
I've gotten better.
Oh, good. Don't we all have our crutch? Don't we all have the one thing that we crave? And, you know,
I think life
is too short for us to totally eliminate even the thing that you love.
Well,
but,
I'm not a coffee drinker. So,
okay,
and
well,
I should probably start. Maybe it's probably better than Diet Coke, right? But I used to have a couple Diet Cokes a day, a couple cans. And now I'm down to maybe three cans a week. And
wow,
you know, sometimes you just need that jolt. However, I have found now that I don't use it regularly that I notice that I come down hard, too.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it does have, when you withdraw from something for a long time, as soon as you have it again, it does, you know, it'll give you a jolt. You're absolutely right. Yep.
Okay.
Then
now,
you get
any
more questions there?
I have some questions. Lizzie wants to know, do you do, like, anything special, like, so that you can work full-time? Like, how do you keep up working full-time? Is there anything that you're doing?
Cindy, I think Lucy is online with us. I'll just bring her live on air so she can join. Lucy, you're live? Lucy Smith, can you hear me? You're live? Hello, Lucy?
Hi. I'm so sorry. I have you on mute, and I couldn't figure out how to unmute my phone. I am here.
Yes. Lucy, yes, Cindy was just asking one of the questions that you want to ask Paula. Maybe you can join the discussion.
Yeah, I attended a little bit late, so I might have missed the answer to my question, but I'm really interested in hearing you talk a little bit more about how your disease was manifested through the scans and not necessarily through blood work, or was that true even the M spike in the urine?
No, I was a little bit of both. My blood work did show elevation. So the blood work did show an elevated M spike, did show a little, the IgG is almost worthless for me now. It showed a little bit of elevation, but it was the PET scan that really revealed really how the activity in my body. And so even though the M spike wasn't dramatic, it wasn't huge, the number, it was enough to cause, you know, tumor progression in my spine. So it was actually the combination of having blood work done. And I was due for my PET scan anyway. I have it every 6 months. But it was just the early part of, it almost happened simultaneously, actually. It's interesting because I think back to, you know, when I had my compression fracture, how sneaky this disease can be. You know, it was such that I was feeling fine every day. Everything looked fine. It wasn't like I had any clue that something was happening. And then one day, oh, my back hurts. Oh, I wonder why. And it's so sneaky on you that you almost don't think, believe it or not, I didn't think it was my lung at the time. Why? Because I had just been to the doctor the month before. My IgG was good. My M spike at the time, because it was like 5 years away out from my transplant. And, you know, you get 5 years on a holiday. After a while, you're saying, maybe I am cured. Ooh, isn't this wonderful? And I went, and the IgG was still normal. Everything was fine. And 2 weeks later, my back hurt. Well, I've had a little bit of mild scoliosis since I was a child. So I'd been, you know, I've had back issues when I was 18 years old, way before myeloma. So the first thought was, well, my myeloma's okay. It must be that I just, you know, pulled something. It doesn't take very much. You know, all you have to do is turn the wrong way, and all of a sudden you're back hurts. And so that's what I thought it was initially. And so maybe a week later and 2 weeks later, it was getting worse and not better. And it was only then that I went, oh, wait, maybe it is. Could it be? And that's when I went for an MRI, my local primary doctor, actually, because I went to her saying, I have a back problem, my back hurts, can you help me? And she said, you sure this is just, you think it's your arthritis or your scoliosis? And you know, she ordered an MRI and said, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have a compression fracture. And she said, I'm stunned that you're able to work. And I said, well, my back hurts a lot. She goes, you must tolerate pain very well, because ordinarily with someone with a compression fracture, they can't even move. And I went, oh, she goes, we're putting you in the hospital immediately. I said, well, I drove here. She goes, you drove here by yourself? I went, oh, yes. So that's me, and that's how I progress. And sure enough,
so did,
the same thing happened this June. I was feeling well. And my numbers, I knew, were kind of progressing, but it's overnight, one day. The next day you go, uh-oh, my back hurts. And there,
so
it's back.
Did your blood work spike at the same time you started getting back pain?
The blood work actually started to show progression a few months before that. But again, the progression was tiny. It went from 0 to 0.1 to 0.2. And that's pretty low. And so we knew that it was progressing, but you don't know at what point would it be. Was, did this mean that you're creating tumors somewhere, and are you going to have pain? You could have very, very, very diffuse disease and not feel pain, but just feel fatigue perhaps. So it's very elusive. It is very individual and very different for in individuals. My M-spike at the time, my back pain, my M-spike was probably, you know, a 0.4 maybe, something like that, or maybe a 0.5, and the back pain came. I went, okay, now we have to do...
Well, Paula, if I could jump in, Lizzie, it's not unusual for you to have a zero M-spike, for a patient to have a zero M-spike, to have normal IgG, even normal light chains. Not be a non-secretor. In other words, you know, you can follow myeloma through either the blood or the urine, serum or the urine, and still develop lesions.
Wow.
It's not unusual at all. As a matter of fact, I guess 1 out of 5 patients will do that. And normally they're not too serious, but often it's discovered when someone breaks an arm or a leg or a rib.
Mm.
Or has a compression fracture like Paula did. And by the way, Paula, just for the record, we are kindred spirits, because when I get to 0.5, everybody panics. At 0.5, I start developing bone involvement as well.
Okay.
So mine starts very, very early.
Yeah.
So here's my question then. I mean, is the answer then to get PET scans every 4 months, 2 months, and then there's the radiation? So...
Yeah.
You know,
once a year is probably plenty. In Paula's case, it's every 6 months, which is great. But you know, again, unless you're showing, she's showing, she's treading that way.
Clinical reason to, you know, and again, some doctors can order them on a regular basis for some survey of assessment of disease. It all depends on your insurance company as well. I'm not sure every 4 months. I think disease takes a little while. I think actually twice a year is adequate to follow someone.
And is it only through a PET scan that these are determined, or do X-rays, or?
Oh, the X-rays wouldn't. Got to remember, the PET scan is so sensitive that it's showing things at a molecular level. I'm sure it wouldn't even show on an X-ray yet. So you're really getting an inside basic molecular level, and that's good and bad. Sometimes you might see something on the PET scan, and I've had PET scans, and they said, you have activity in these places. I go, I do. I feel nothing. No, I don't feel anything in those areas. And so you have that insight, and it does come with a level of anxiety, the PET scans, but then I'm the kind of person that I want the information, and I'll deal with my anxiety. But understanding that you do want to take this over a period of time and allow the treatment to work. Some, if you know, some insurance companies could be like mine, who would say, if your doctor can follow you using the inexpensive, now they don't use that term, blood work, because what does blood work cost? A couple hundred dollars a month, perhaps? A PET scan, we're talking about thousands, like $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 a month. Where I live, that's how expensive the PET scans are. So insurance companies are very smart. They're in business to make money. They're not going to pay for a PET scan if you could be followed with a $300 blood test. And that's what happened. They followed me for the first 7 years of my disease or so using blood work. And we were all happy and thinking it was fine until it proved that, in my situation, I need it more than that. And it, I truly believe it didn't take my doctor very much to justify it. But I think insurance company will need justification for the PET scan. I remember saying to my doctor one time, you know, I had the PET scan and it showed some activity. And I said, I don't want to wait 6 months. Can we petition and get them to pay for it in 3 months? And he said, maybe. He said, but honestly, it's okay. The difference, he said, let's just do the 6 month. If we have to, if there's some compelling reason, perhaps. But, you know, let's work with them. It's been okay in the past. The disease is slowish to begin with. That would be fine. So you do have to be a little patient, because once you have it, you want to know immediately, is it working? I'm curious. I'm on a new regimen. My PET scan was in June. I have to be patient. I'm going to have it in December, and I can't do anything about that. So I just have to take my drugs and tolerate and figure out how to go to work full-time and still manage my disease. And in December, I'll have the PET scan, and we'll see where I am then.
Very interesting. Thank you. It'll be interesting to see how things happen with the whole new insurance exchange coming up. So I'm hoping that insurance is still good in January.
It's going to take quite a while. That's quite a mess to kind of sort out. But again,
Hopefully it will be seamless.
A question that, like, how do I manage to go to work full time? Well, you know, I sometimes ask myself that question. But I have to say, the Tom Dex, the pill, made life very easy for me, because I didn't have to go to the doctors very often. I just took my pill, both the Palm and the Dex pills, take it, put it along with my vitamins every day, and off I go. And was I a little bit tired? Yes, I was a little tired. Could I modify my work schedule a little? Well, my supervisors were very receptive, and they said, if you're tired and you need to kind of sleep in a little bit, just let us know and come in late in the morning. They knew full well that if I came in late in the morning, I'd probably stay over at night. But so they gave me the freedom to do that, and I know I'm fortunate. Lots of people don't have that flexibility. But I think also the advent of the computer and electronics and emailing, I mean, I can do much more from home than I ever could do before. So even when I may not feel up to going into the office, which doesn't happen very often, I can, in the comfort of my own home and my fuzzy slippers and my rye toast and a cup of tea, I can still work. And I think that has helped tremendously in allowing me to continue to work. And the other part of it is, I like going to work because it takes my mind off my myeloma. And for hours and for the day, and even when I'm home, and I work at a university, and I have students writing to me, and they have all these issues going on, can you help, can you help? And then I look up, and 2 hours have gone by, and I haven't thought about myeloma in 2 hours, and that's good. And I feel rewarded because I'm helping someone else, and I'm not thinking about me. And I think, you know, that helps a lot. We're all in this, we have every good reason to be anxious and watch our numbers and try to analyze everything we do about our disease. But that pay comes with a price. I mean, you don't want to be in that mode all the time. And, you know, working to me has helped me very, very much live my life in a productive way and not have to focus on my disease all the time. So if I wasn't working, I'd probably be doing things like Cindy's doing, volunteering and Twittering. And I, you know, because I need to spend, I know me, I need to spend time away from the disease. I feel good when I'm helping other people. And I don't focus on myself. And that's rewarding to me. So, now, again, I've had the benefit of having a very supportive work environment, and my colleagues at work are very supportive. So now, with the carfilzomib infusion, this has become more challenging for me because now I am going to a doctor's office Monday, Tuesday, for 3 weeks of the month, I actually go to an office and I have an infusion. It takes me out of the office much more. I'm traveling more. I'm facing my disease more than ever before because now I'm having infusions at a regular basis. Unlike the Pomdex, when it was just a pill, it was a wonderful thing, just having a pill. But, you know, it is what it is, and you know, it's important. I understand why I had to add the carfilzomib or why I decided to add the carfilzomib. And I'm just hoping at this point I'm willing to, you know, make that sacrifice and rearrange my life. And it is more difficult now for me to work. But, again, my colleagues are very supportive. And, you know, I'm trying to arrange that every Monday and Tuesday I'm spending at least a half a day in the doctor's office, but I'll be there sometime in the afternoon, and sometimes if I don't really feel well, I'll call and say, oh, you know, I'm going to go right home. And they know they can reach me because, you know, whether it be on your phone or your computer, you're reachable. And whether, you know, so it's I've been able, because I have a job that allows that, it's been something I've been able to manage.
Oh, Cindy, I got another question. It just popped in my head. You're on a clinical trial for the carfilzomib pomalidomide combination, right? It's part of a trial?
No, I'm not on a trial because the carfilzomib or Kyprolis is FDA approved, so I'm taking that commercially. And the POM and the DEX, even though I was on a trial for a long time, the fact that I had to go off the trial because I wanted to go back up. So now I'm taking Pomdex commercially. So I just happened to qualify for both of them. So I'm taking both of them commercially. I'm not on a trial.
Okay.
Which gives
so, that's, so you're able to get your carfilzomib at your local doctor's office instead of having to travel to your specialist?
Correct. Although it comes FedEx, it actually gets mailed to me. Where when I was strictly on the Pomdex trial, the doctor's office gave me my pills in a little brown lunch bag, which I always thought was quite cute. And that's because the only way to get that drug was through a trial, through a center that had permission to give the drug out. Once I was off the trial, I now went back to it commercially where it comes from the specialty pharmacy, and it gets mailed to me through FedEx. So that my pills come to me through a FedEx. And carfilzomib is an infusion, so I'm actually getting it infused in. And my local oncologist can do it now. I don't have to go to my myeloma center because it's now FDA approved. Prior to this, you know, the Kyprolis was only available through your clinical trial center. So you'd have to go to that location, which makes it a problem for lots of people who don't live close enough to a big myeloma center to participate in the clinical trial. So since both of those are now approved, I can have them done. I can have my infusion locally and my POM for my carfilzomib and my POM, not the desk, but the POM, it gets sent to me through FedEx.
Okay.
Paula, you've been a marvelous guest, and I'm guessing that we've just about run out of time. How are we doing, Priya?
You're absolutely right, Pat. It's actually been wonderful listening to Paula. And yes, we have kind of crossed the time limit. Paula, thank you so much for taking time out and being with us and answering our questions. Thank you so much. Pat and Cindy, it's always great to work with you and have you here on the Cure Panel Talk Show. Thank you so, so much. The link for today's broadcast will be sent to all participants as well as will be posted on CureTalk. You can always contact me, priya@trilex.com, for all queries about our shows. Our next Myeloma Cure Panel is featuring Dr. Paul Richardson from Harvard's Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Please visit trilex.com/curetalk for more details on the shows. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Good night. Thank you so much.
Cindy. Bye, everyone.
Good night,
thank
everyone.
Thank you, Paula.
You're very welcome, Pat. Take care.
Yes. Bye. Be well. Good night.
Good night.